Okay, thank you for all those people who write down these questions for the happiness and entertainment of everybody. Here we go. Dear Ajahn Brahm, it was truly an awe-inspiring Dhamma talk this morning. With my sights still on the high peaks, I went back to sit and find I'm still struggling to get my gear together back at base camp. Could we have a few words of motivation, please, for those of us still trying to let go and focus on the breath with deep respect? Yeah, I love giving those talks like this morning, and I got myself all blissed out as a result of it. So I enjoy it. It's just for me. I don't care about other people. But nevertheless, I give those talks anyway, because now and again, someone gets close. You know what's happening. Or actually, you do actually gain those stages, and then you understand what it is. And it's very rare to hear a talk like that, so it's great to put it out there so you can remember it. And maybe, if not this retreat, another retreat, maybe next year or next lifetime, who knows, but the seeds put in there somewhere of what the jhanas are. And it gives a deeper explanation of what Buddhism is and also the place of these jhanas. But they're all built on contentment, on peace. In telling people in their interviews that it's like growing a tree. And you have to water that tree, and you water that tree not with wanting or desire. That kills the tree, the Bodhi tree of enlightenment. You water that tree with peace. As much peace as you can possibly put on there. Being peace to the moment. Being content with what you're experiencing. That is the water which grows a tree. And soon that tree flowers, and the flower is the jhanas. The fruit is enlightenment. That's all what happens. So your job to watch the breath is just make peace with the breath. And that's the way into jhanas. Wanting them. I'm as good as anybody else. I'm going to get jhana this evening, so I can get out of the way and do something else in my life. That's not what happens with jhanas. The more you want them, the more they recede away from you. You have to be kind, peaceful, make peace with every moment. And that's watering the Bodhi tree. Doesn't matter what you're experiencing. You can be restless, you can be slothful, you can be just completely bored out of your skull. Make peace with it. Whatever's happening, make peace. And then you're creating the conditions. The way the Buddha taught it, one of his similes, which is, gives you hope, gives you inspiration, but it also happens to be very true. It's a simile of a water jar. Those of you who've been to Asia, you see these huge water jars. Imagine one bigger than you, and you can see water dripping into that jar. But you can't tell how much water's already in there, whether it's almost empty or almost full or somewhere in the middle. All you can see is water dripping in. And the point is, you don't know how close you might be. Your job is just to put some more water in that jar, some more peace into the moment. Keep making the peace. And afterwards, you'll find, when you least expect it, you just do another moment of peace, and the water jar is full. That's the last little drop. You don't know when that last drop is. It could be tonight. And it happens to people. They're sitting here when they least expect it. Just make a little bit more peace. Wham, bam, zam. And you're into the jhanas. And this is true. This is what happens. You don't know how close you are or how far you are. Look, a water jar is high in your head. You can't see inside. So it does not matter to worrying about, oh, the jar, is it full or is it empty? Your job is just to keep pouring some more water in it. And the water is peace, contentment, letting go. And if you keep putting water in that jar, you know for certain, one thing you can be sure of, is one day that water jar will be full. And the more you actually put peace into the moment, the more you put water into that jar, you know, the quicker it's going to be full. That's why patience is the fastest way. Peace is the path. Letting go is right effort. Contentment is your wise application of your effort. So learn to be content. Learn to be peaceful. And you just go deeper and deeper. And really, you know, it doesn't really matter getting into jhanas, because these are all gradual deepening of meditation. It's not like you're just wasting your time if you don't get jhanas. The point is, the closer you get, the more profound, the more peaceful, the more blissful your meditation is, the more fun it gets. So even if you only get halfway on the road to jhanas, wow, that's the best thing you've ever done in your life. So as you get deeper and more peaceful, you get these incremental rewards. The closer you get, the more rewards you get. That's all it is. So even if you get halfway to jhana, that is worth 1,000 retreats. You get really peaceful just watching this beautiful breath go in and go out, completely at ease, having a great time. The point is, if you've already got that far, one thing I can say, if you keep making peace with that, contentment with that, it gets more intense, more peaceful, more blissful, more fun. It gets more and more. And when it gets that much, as the water jar gets more and more full, it starts to glow and get brighter and more happy. And then the whole water jar overflows. More bliss than a water jar can hold. That's what happens. So the point is, so just try and be more peaceful, more still. More letting go. And you get more happy. That's enough. And then jhanas happen in their due course. So that's the encouragement for you. You're on the way. If you haven't done it yet, remember also the story about going to work on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And you don't get any check. And you go to work on Friday. And you still don't get a check. Because the boss says, "Sir, madam, the check is in the mail." And that is for you. I can guarantee the check is in the mail for you. It's coming soon. And the point is, you've got to be very mindful. You've got to be very peaceful and alert. Because if you're thinking of something else, when the postman calls, he sends a check back. So you've got to be waiting. Alert in the moment. Waiting for your postman to deliver your check with your name on it. Jhana. But if you're thinking of something else, worrying about something else, then you miss the postman. So you miss your check. Okay? Any comments about that? Yeah, go on. You mean you're going back home? Oh, I was expecting everyone to come to our monastery afterwards, become monks and nuns. Okay, first of all, where is your home? Your home is in the present moment. Singapore does not exist except a figment of your imagination. So, the retreat, this is, I've been saying this is to all today. For those of you who weren't on interview, if you start thinking about what you're going to do at the end of this retreat, then you might as well go home now. The retreat has ended for you. As soon as you start planning for the future, you've lost the present moment. The retreat is over. So don't start even thinking about what's going to happen at the end until 1 or 2 seconds before the end. That's all. Don't think about what's going to happen when I go home. You might not make it. So, what a waste of time worrying about all these things. The best thing to do is just be in the present moment as much as you possibly can. In this retreat, be irresponsible. All these things you were taught when you were a kid, plan for this, plan for that, stop it. You could be completely irresponsible. No plans whatsoever. Who knows when the retreat is going to end? For those of you who've read my little book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, there's a great story of the retreat. And if you don't know that story, it's a great one to read. Because it shows what happens with anticipation. Do you know that story? Okay, I'll let you know it then. This was one of the friends, a New Zealand monk, He ordained in Korea, in a very tough monastery, when they have retreats, not namby-pamby wimp stuff, just 9 days, 60 days. Not getting up at 4, getting up at 3, or earlier if you wanted. And there was none of this, you can sit as long as you like. Because actually you slept in the hall. Where you actually sit, that's where you slept. So at 3 o'clock, you had to get up and just sit. 50 minutes sit, 10 minute walk, 50 minutes sit, 10 minute walk. All throughout the day, even your breakfast and lunch, you had to have it cross-legged exactly where you were sitting in meditation. Really disciplined, really firm. And the only time out was to go to the toilet or to see the interview, and not like Ajahn Brahm just lazing back on the chairs. He was firm, shouting at you, asked you to work harder. So, but there was none of these cushions either, or chairs, on the hard wooden floor. It was tough. It was mean. Not for the faint-hearted. And this was just like a Westerner, who was like, you know, pretty fit, but after 3 or 4 days of that, he was really in agony. And he said, what am I doing this for? This is stupid. But, you know, he's a monk, and all the other people monks, looked at all the Korean monks, and he started saying, well, you know, I'm a Caucasian, they're Koreans, if they can do it, I can do it. It's like racial pride, got it through another day. That's all. But then every time he thought he was going to leave, because he couldn't stand any longer, I'd just give it another hour. And he pushed through that way. And it's just real agony. You know what it's like, you know, sitting for so long, and there was no way out. And 30 days went past, and that was like an eon it took. But after the 30 days, it felt as if you got halfway, you know, you're just on the home stretch. But it doesn't work that way, because the second 30 days are much longer than the first 30 days. Because you're aching and you're sore. And the days just went by so slowly. And it was just pure endurance, that's all. And when it got to the last day, you woke up in the morning thinking, well, it's one more day and I'm finished with this. But the last day, like most last days, if you go into anticipation, is the longest day of all. Those hours, they just stretched into eternity. And the clock went so slow, as if the batteries had all run out. But sooner or later, you always come to the last hour. Even eternity has an end. And as that last hour began, it's just thinking of all what would happen after the retreat was over. Because you were allowed to have these hot baths, like in Korea. And your legs and your back and everything is aching so much. This was just like ecstasy, just the thought of a hot bath where you could stretch out and just eat, you could talk, you can just, you know, do whatever you want, have a sleep in the following morning. He was thinking and planning all these things he's going to do in 1 hour's time. And that hour lasted for such a long time. And that was the most agony of all. Even though it's the last hour, sometimes you thought you just can't make it. The pain was just reached a crescendo at the very end. But then he heard the bell, the gong for ending the retreat. And he used to remember him telling me, he said, these waves of bliss came right through his body. He'd done something really hard, 60-day intense retreat like that, and going through all that pain. And just see, the bliss just blotted out the pain. And he felt so happy and so high as he bowed and got up to go to his bath. But he heard the bell go again. And the master, the teacher, said, wait a minute, there's an announcement to be made. And the teacher said, during your interviews, many of you monks have been telling me just how much progress you've got on this retreat, how special it is for you. And you've asked me to extend the retreat for another 2 weeks. I think that's a good idea. Carry on sitting. So they extended the retreat for another 2 weeks. And so no bath. He had to cross his legs and carry on sitting. Imagine what he felt like. No pain, he said. He didn't feel any pain at all, just sheer anger, just murderous ill will, as he was trying to think who those B-I-S-T-I-R-D-S monks were. who made that suggestion, what he's going to do to them afterwards. And as he was planning his retribution, bell went again. About 15 or 20 minutes had gone past in a flash. And the master, the teacher said, okay, retreat over. Refreshments downstairs, hot baths, enjoy. And he couldn't think, what's going on, what's going on? Is retreat over, not over? And that's when one of the other monks came up who could speak English. He said, the master, he does this every year. He really taught him a lesson. It's just anticipation created all that pain. You don't know when the retreat's going to be over. Who said it's going to be over on Saturday? During your interviews, many of you said how wonderful this retreat is. So that way, just you can forget about all this planning business. Enjoy every moment. And when you're open to uncertainty, you're not expecting anything at all, not even the end of a retreat, let alone a jhana, then you have peace. Don't live a life of expectations. Otherwise, you get frustrated, and that frustration of unrealistic expectation will make you very angry. So just let go of expectation. Then what's going to happen? So you're completely at peace with the moment. This retreat ends today. We decide, oh, you've had enough, let's go. Or it keeps on going for another 5 years. You're completely at peace with whatever happens. So, oh, I didn't get that. Dear Ajahn, in a nutshell, can you define emptiness? Yeah, the absence of the nut in its shell. It's obvious, isn't it? That's a dead giveaway, that one. Next question. Well, what is your view about monks having seniority over nuns? And do you ever see a time when that tradition will change, or perhaps it doesn't necessitate a change? For example, maybe they could get their meals served first, or alongside the monks. No? Okay. When nuns wear beards... No, I can't say things like that. No. That's an interesting question. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know the answer to it. See what happens in the future. Is my understanding that only blissful mindfulness may lead to a nimitta correct? Could you kindly explain the term blissful, please? Okay, there's many different types of happiness and pleasure to be found in the world. And there's some pleasures, some happinesses, which are, you can actually know them. They're just too restless, they're too bubbly, they're too exciting, they're too causing of restlessness. They just come and go. And they're just very unstable. So you know those happinesses which are unstable. And they can never lead to sort of like nimittas or jhanas. But there's the other type of happinesses which you may know which are more profound. They're very, very deep and very still happinesses. Not bubbly, not boiling happinesses. But just so still, so peaceful. But they sort of just, what am I, they glow, they radiate. Joy and happiness. And it's nice actually to be able to come to a retreat and explore the different types of happiness to be found in the world. Because some people only know a few types of happiness, you know, sex, movies, the joy when you get what you want, soccer team wins, or Sri Lanka win the World Cup or something, or something wonderful happens to you. But that only lasts for such a small time, a few moments. But there's other types of happiness which are deeper and more powerful. And after a while you get to know those happinesses, those joys, which are conducive to deeper meditation. Because it does happen. This is one of the teachings I don't really give all that often. But sometimes you get into very powerful, blissful states in meditation. But they're just too bubbly, they're just too moving around all the time, too exciting. And those ones, that type of happiness, I can recognize that and I just let that one go. I don't get into that one at all. Even just like sometimes, you know, you're sitting there and you get thrills through the body. The body's just like electric. Oh, this is really nice. Wow, really nice. Really, but it's just too unstable, And I know that that's, you know, you might as well enjoy it if you want to, just for a few seconds or minutes or whatever, but it's not going to lead you into nimittas and jhanas. But when you really let go and you get peaceful and still, everything sort of calms down, then sort of a joy comes up, which is even more intense, it's more delicious, but more peaceful. It sort of has this quality of just softness, but depth. It's like this beautiful big lake of cool water, just radiating joy. And those are the sort of happinesses, the joys I know lead to actually stability, and a nimitta comes up from there. And there's those blisses, which I know lead to jhanas. And as you go into this, you get these incredibly more peaceful, stable blisses come up one after the other, of the jhanas. You might say that the levels of jhana are just an investigation into the different types of happiness to be found in the world. You're becoming like a gourmet of bliss. And most people never go to those restaurants. Or they can't afford it, they think, or they just don't know the route into those restaurants. They haven't got the membership card. But once you know the way into those restaurants, you get some incredible happinesses and bliss. Which once you know those, you never go to the junk food restaurants, where, you know, you just only get ordinary happinesses, what people have in the world. So this is what real bliss is. And yes, you find this. Many of you already have meditated, you get so happy, so joyful. I think some of you probably already understand that this meditation is much happier than sex. It's even happier than falling in love. It's a deeper happiness. So this is, you're really finding out what joy is. And it's, the term blissful, I use it as a very wide word, but there's some blisses which you find out as why, out of this world. So it's fun to meditate. Any questions about that? That's why people stay as monks or nuns. Is that the bliss of it? And that's maybe just the seniority. It doesn't really worry you. If nuns want to go ahead of me, that's fine. Because it's not important. I didn't become a monk to be senior. I became a monk to bliss out. Dear Ajahn Brahm, today I did a pre-dawn walking meditation, followed by a sitting meditation. Soon after starting the sit, I felt the sensation of ants crawling all over my body. I remember what you said and was fully expecting a nimitta to rise. But no, these were real ants. I could see that coming. I had disturbed during my walk in the dark. More seriously, last night when sitting, I was experiencing sustained awareness of the beautiful breath and had this really weird sensation of my head and body expanding like a dirigible balloon, with my little legs hanging off like a caricature. It's actually a really nice feeling that I've had before on retreats. Can you explain it? Yes. This is what happens in this place. Is we got something, like we call that perception, just the way we look at life, the way we interpret things. And when you practice this meditation, samadhi, I call it like you're giving perception wings. So perception can actually see and do things it's trained not to do in ordinary life. To see things in weird and strange ways. This is what happens. You are just so conditioned to perceive things in one way or two ways by our culture, by our upbringing. We're taught, we're brainwashed, we're channeled to have such a limited range of perceptions. People are supposed to be people. Their heads are not supposed to expand. And for a lot of people, if you said that to a psychologist, you know, a psychiatrist, they'd put you on some drug or something, because they wouldn't understand what was going on. But once you know perception, this is just what happens. When the perception gets freed, because the five hindrances start to disappear, you get all sorts of weird things. You look at the wall, and the wall becomes jelly and starts to melt in front of your eyes. You fill up the whole wall with your being, the whole room with your being. You expand. Then you go through the walls and just expand over the whole Perth. You're that fat. You can do all these sorts of things. And this is what happens. The person that had that experience, they were getting into a peaceful, joyful state, and you got to the stage, what I call perception gaining wings. It's good fun to follow that because you can do all sorts of weird things. But it's the stage before jhanas, before nimittas usually. It's good fun, you can play around there for a while, but then come back, go back onto your breath. You've already got strong mind at this stage. Go back onto your breath and get a nice nimitta up and go onto the path of inner stillness rather than go and play around with the nimittas in the mind. Sometimes you can get like light shows going on in your mind. Sometimes you can get these amazing visions. Sometimes you can play around like this and have really interesting fun in what the mind can do. It's like having your own sort of DVD inside. Any special effects, bam, zoom, and there it is. Okay, great fun to play around with those states. This perception becomes free. However, it's interesting. It's a good sign. Sign that meditation is working. It's a little paycheck, not the real thing, but you know, a free gift, a freebie. Most meditation teachers say don't indulge in that. But I rebel against those. I say, look, you've worked so hard. Sure, it's not going to lead to nirvana. It's not going to lead to jhana, but it's going to encourage you. Now, you've got somewhere. There's a little bit of a payoff. Enjoy it. Have a bit of fun. Play. Then when you finish playing, you can go back to work again. And that's what happens. Perception gaining its wings. You start to see things in completely different ways. Sometimes you look at somebody and they turn into a skeleton. There's a skeleton in front of you. Or they just all drip into a pool of goo. You can do whatever you like. It's good fun. You can turn somebody and just see them in front of you, just get into an old man and see all their skin wrinkle and fall off. You do all these perceptions. That's what you sometimes do. The most common perception of the forest monks is to look at someone and just to see them as a skeleton. And that's what they do, they turn into a skeleton right in front of you. And that's actually how you see them, how perception actually changes the image. So it's great to do things like that. Changing the perceptions, messing around. Yeah? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it can get to be ugly or it can become beautiful. Mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the fairest of them all? Change your perception to this beautiful princess. Yeah, it's me. But the point is that, yeah, it can be scary. Like meditation can be scary. What's scary is that your perception is actually going beyond the bounds of what you're comfortable with. But it's perfectly safe. You don't go crazy, you don't go mad, because it disappears after a while, you come back again. Or if you come to the teacher after, say, yeah, this is what happens. It's just perception. It's just going over the boundaries. And it comes back again afterwards. No trouble at all. So it's not scary. It's just a bit of fun, that's all. And you're always in control. One of the stories which I often tell people is when I was a young monk, very early on, I think it was before I was a monk, a layperson, I was meditating quite peacefully. And the perception in my mind was of this demon right in front of me. And this demon that was so ugly and so frightening, and it's right in front of me. But I recognized it straight away, because it's like a demon with one of those Tibetan paintings. It had his like skulls around its neck. It had his big fangs dripping blood, the oozing blood down its cheek. These big eyes, like big balls of eyes. I don't know what else it had on it, but it looked pretty frightening. But as soon as I know it, this is perception. It's not a real thing. So I know I can play with this perception. And so I did. Just like when I was at school, I used to doodle on his cartoons or whatever. And I doodled on this picture. I blacked out a few of its fangs so it had like holes in its teeth. I did, that's very easy to do. And I sort of turned the corner of its mouth, it was down, like, you know, really angry. Up, so it was like had this silly smile on its face. And I put a cigarette out of its mouth, like you usually do. And this big straw hat with a flower coming out on its head. I think that was a lot. That was the final straw. When I put the hat on it with a flower in it, it looked so ridiculous. I turned this demon into an object of ridicule, and I just laughed, and the demon just disappeared, never came back again. That's how you deal with demons. Just make a joke of them. And they can't frighten you anymore. It's just perception, that's what it was. I told that story to this lady about 10 years ago, because she was a young meditator, and she came, she was very frightened. She said she was meditating, and she heard this voice. She said, "I am a demon, and I've come to take over your mind." Ah, she came. She said, "What am I going to do? I just heard this demon. I heard it. So it's going to come and take over my mind." I said, "Ah, come on. That's like a burglar," I said, "knocking on your door and says, 'Excuse me, madam, I'm going to come to burgle your house tonight.'" No burglar does that. Think of a burglar, they just come in. If it was a real demon, they just come up and take over your mind. That's right. So she understood what I was saying, laughed. And of course, it was just a perception coming up into the mind of fear. And that's just the way she perceived it. So that was the end of that problem. She just carried on meditating, never heard that thing again. So these are just perceptions, what we do. How the mind can actually make up all this wonderful, amazing, and weird stuff. So if you know what you're doing, you can play around there. It's not, and I encourage you to play around there. Just see what goes on. You're absolutely perfectly safe because you're always in complete control. If you want to stop any time, just stop. Just come back to the breath. But at that stage, the mind is very subtle, very malleable. So just go for it. But if you're a young girl and do that, obviously that's a bit too young. You haven't got a teacher there to say, "Oh, go and play and you can come back after us." Because you can create some positive things in there as well. If you see a little demon, you can like doodle with it. And if a demon comes along to say, "I've come to take over your mind," you can have a bit of fun with it. Say, "How much? How much do you want it for?" Do some bargaining. $1,000? Nah, it's worth much more than that. About 10 grand. 10 grand, 5 grand, 6 grand, done. It doesn't fun. Could not take over your mind. Anyway, okay, that's that. So that's the dirigible balloon. It's just beautiful perceptions. It happens when you get samadhi. Sitting there, just the mind gets really big or whatever. So one of the things which people do have sometimes is sometimes they're meditating there and sometimes they think they're leaning over or they're leaning forward. It's very, very common. And I tell them, look, now I've opened my eyes, I've seen you not leaning forward, you're not leaning to the side, it's just, your mind is just, perception is playing tricks on you, that's all. And sometimes you need to get a video, to actually take a video of them to see that he's absolutely straight. But the mind thinks it's on leaning, it's just perception is just starting to mess around a bit. And the interesting thing about that is just to know just how our perception of things is so conditioned. And it stops us actually seeing just the full range of possibilities. We always think the brick walls are solid. In perception, we can see right through them sometimes. It's just the mind playing around, that's all. And it's great when you can change perceptions. Any questions about that? Okay, next question. While meditating this afternoon, after being in a pleasant moment awareness, focusing on the breath for some time, I experienced sudden waves of complete ecstasy, joy, filling my mind. Great, well done. About 3 or 4 in a row. That's all. Then back to breathing on the breath. Is this just the mind filling with joy or something else? Thank you. Yeah, it's just some of the payoffs, some of the checks coming through. It's just when you get focusing on the breath for some time, you get very, very stern, you get these incredible feelings of bliss and joy. They start maybe with the body, but if they start and go onto the body, they don't usually last very long. So just go back onto the breath and see if you can let go of the breath and get that joy coming up into the mind, that bliss going into the mind. It's much more enjoyable when it's what just goes on the body. But even that joy in the body is pretty nice. So I always say, wow, this is really nice. Wow, this is good. So enjoy it. But don't crave it. You can enjoy it without craving it. If you start craving it, it disappears. If you aren't starting to feel with it, again, it doesn't last. So just enjoy it. Leave it alone. And it lasts the longest. And it's also you can enjoy it the most. Just the mind is becoming strong. A little bit of superpower mindfulness there. See if you can do it all the time. So your body is just electric with bliss. Pulsating ecstasy. Who said retreats are dull? Very good, well done. Then Ajahn, are we supposed to share what we experience in the meditation? Thank you. Only if it's good. If you have got anger and ill will, you don't share it with somebody else. Yeah, you can share sometimes, because sometimes when you ask a question like that, you know, you've got the joy ecstasy going through the body, because sometimes it helps other people understand what they feel too. Or if they don't feel it now, what they felt before, what they might feel in the future. So you get some more understanding of what's going on. And the biggest thing, why I spent a lot of time a few seconds ago talking about like demons coming up and perceptions coming up, because this is what happens. It's a natural part of the process of meditation, just perception starting to play around. Once you know what's going on, you're not going crazy, you're not going mad, no one's come to take over your mind, it's just nature, that's all. So once you know what's happening, you can enjoy it and have play. You can actually have more fun with the meditation. If you get ecstasy through the body, you know what's happening. It's great. It's good. Superpower mindfulness. The mind is getting so strong. It's looking at the body. It just puts all this amazing bliss in the body. You know, there's nothing wrong there. Great. Enjoy it. Have fun. And part of the payoff of meditation. And don't think you're going to get attached to that. No need to worry. These are good things. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I get a bit of happiness from my walking meditation. My sitting meditation is a sham. Please, Ajahn, what is going on? Side, walking, smiling, sitting, frowning. Okay. Now, what can we do here? Okay. You can sit down, close your eyes, and imagine that you're walking meditation. Just sit down and imagine you're walking, lifting up your foot, moving forward, lifting down. If you can do that. The point is that sometimes we get into these ruts of perception again. We think, I can't do sitting meditation. I can only do walking meditation. Which is why I think I said earlier on in this retreat, if you can't do the sitting meditation, if you haven't got anywhere yet, imagine you can do the sitting meditation. Sit down there and imagine just waves of bliss going through your body. Just imagine it. Imagine just breathing in and just waves of bliss coming in. Breathing out, waves of bliss going out. Breathing in, just so peaceful. Imagine breathing out, just so lovely. And continue that for just a minute or two. Then you can let go of the imagination. You find you're just already, you're just pretty still. You've got the breath in mind. It's just like using a bit of psychology. When you think, I can't do this, I'm hopeless at this, then of course you're not able to do it. And this is, I don't know, maybe because of being monks in past life or whatever, but I really, when I was teaching, there was this guy at school, bottom of the class in mathematics, and I never really believed at the beginning that the guy was hopeless. So I gave him extra attention. It's a story in the book, gave him extra attention. After the class, went up to him, did you understand that? Can I explain it to you again? Really encouraging throughout the whole year. And after 1 year, the end of the year exams, he came top. I took him from the bottom to the top just by confidence, that's all. And that's what sometimes, whoever that is, I'm going to take you from being a hopeless sitting meditator to the best. Against real jhanas in the next 1 or 2 days. Just by confidence, that's all. It's amazing just the belief in oneself and one's ability. You can do it. It's crucial. So never think, oh, I'm hopeless. I can't do this. I've been doing this for such a long time and I can't do this. That belief is what stops you. So, give yourself confidence. I can do this. Use imagination. One of the little tricks, which is nice at the beginning of your meditation, especially sitting meditation, you close your eyes, get your body comfortable, and then remember, recall the most peaceful, happy experience of your life so far. The time when you felt so content, so comfortable, when everything in the world has just been so lovely for you. And picture that and fill in as many details as possible. The place where you were, the people around you, the situation, whether it's a house or in the open, if it's by a lake, the trees which are around there. Picture that, remember as much as you can. All the time remembering the peace of the most wonderful moment of your life so far. And once you've dwelt in that for a minute or two, then let go of the details, the place, the time, the people, and just start watching the breath. You'll find you have the peace there as well. You've dwelt on that peaceful feeling, the most peaceful feeling of your life. Now the details disappear, you've got the breath, and you still have the peace. It's a great way to sort of kick-start the meditation. So that's for that person who wrote that question, have a difficult time sitting meditation. Start the meditation that way. Sit down comfortably. Imagine the most peaceful, contented moment of your life so far. Fill out all the details in your mind, with your eyes closed, imagination. And then when you're ready, just let go of all the details. Take out the breath straight away. And you find the breath is just so nice. Because you keep the peace. Great way of starting a meditation. Next one. Dear Ajahn, are Buddhism and Hinduism similar in ultimate truth? In meditation we practice let go, which leads to a total surrender of self. Isn't that similar to Christianity and Islam? Ultimately, all world religions arrive at the same destiny. Please advise. Okay. When you get very still in meditation, there's no difference between you and the person sitting next to you. You disappear, and with it all the religions disappear as well. You go into nothingness. All those religions, they're just signposts. All the books are just menus. I know that they used to have these restaurants in the UK, sort of one half of them was like for workers, like truck drivers. And the other half of them was like quite a posh restaurant. They had nice tables and clean tablecloths, and the waiters wore suits. And the other one, they were just quite sloppy. But they served the same food. Exactly the same food, different prices. Because the one on the right there was, you know, for sort of expensive people. They could come in their nice suits and nice dresses, sit at nice tables. And the other half was just, you know, workers who just quick, quick lunch. Exactly the same food. But it's just presented differently. So I think that's what the different religions are. The same restaurant, but they look very different outside. This is Jesus Christ's cave. This is the Buddha's restaurant. This is whatever it is. But because what you're doing, you're going inside beyond all of that stuff. All the religions, they all differ because of their books. When you go to the heart of those books, that's why the holy book, the real holy book, is not written on pieces of paper. It's written on your heart, inside. Because that's what all those holy books are supposed to be pointing at. And if we actually think that the book is the final word on things, then we will argue. If we think the experience in our heart is the final word, then we'll all come together in peace. Sure, we may have different menus. May look like different restaurants, but it's the same food inside. So that's where we just go to the heart of our religion. The soft, peaceful, loving, calm heart. And there, you can have friends with anybody. That make sense? Okay. The trouble is, too many people in their religions, Buddhism is included, they just stop at the books. They don't go any further. They end up banging each other on the head with their books. Dear Ajahn, seeing the walls of these buildings, they have two good bricks and about 998 bad ones. That's true, isn't it? That's this big one. You did do badly after all. Now the question, Ajahn, why does the mind like to seek faults even while trying to meditate? You know why it tries to seek faults? Because if you see a fault, it gives you something to do. And it gives you something to do, you feel you are somebody. And that enforces your ego. That's why we always like to look at newspapers and see the scandals. We see the faults in everyone else. It makes us feel good. If I tell you all the faults of everybody on this retreat, all the terrible meditations they have had, that makes you feel good. Oh, I'm not that bad. We always like to look at the faults because the faults give us something to do. And seeing what's right in the world gives us peace, nothing to do anymore. The thing with this doer, which I haven't mentioned, this was seen by many psychologists, many philosophers, that the whole idea of doing is very much caught up with your identity. Some of you ask, you know, what do you do? That's, you know, your description of yourself. I'm an engineer. I'm a monk. I'm a meditation teacher. I'm a doctor. That's not who you are. That's what you do. But we take on as our identity so much that to do nothing is almost as if we don't exist. Our self, our place in society, our worth suddenly disappears. But we don't do anything. So when you come here and people ask you, what do you do for the weekend? Nothing. It's as if you just stepped out of the world. You don't exist anymore. You're meaningless to society. This is the illusion of society. Thinking to be somebody, you have to do something. The point is that when you stop doing things, then you really sort of experience, you know, oneness, peace, bliss. But it also means you have to die as well. Because that's what happens. That's actually how doctors know someone is dead. They poke them, they don't do anything. It's true. That's why sometimes in the morning, someone might poke you and not quite sure whether you're dead or just sleeping. So this is actually what to be dead is, to do nothing. There's another type of doing nothing that's in the jhanas, in the deep meditations, which is why those deep meditations and death are sometimes so close. But there you're not dead because you're fully alert in deep meditations. But you're not doing anything. You find this amazing place where you can be without doing. You can be still and blissed. So that's an interesting thing there. That's why we always find fault, because we want to do things. And that is the only way we know how to be. In meditation, you can learn another way of being, to be without doing. It's far more fun. When you look at the world, you find no fault at all. You can see the perfection in the ordinary. Isn't it a wonderful thing to do? Then you can have some rest in life. When you see faults, you'll always be stressed out. I mentioned this many years ago when I took over being the abbot. You'd go to Nala Mara on the weekend and you'd work hard, you know, teaching, doing a bit of managing as well, because you're also the spiritual director. And things go wrong, they go and talk to you. You have to make those final decisions. So it's really hard work on the weekend. And after the weekend was finished, you go to the monastery and have to fix up all the faults which happened there on the weekend. You know, doing any building work, any monks having problems or whatever, letters being written or whatever. And then I got to the point there that the monastery, although Nala Mara, was always a place of work. There was never any rest. It was doing something. And I decided after a while that on Monday morning, I'd go for a walk in the monastery, in my monastery, and deliberately look for all the things which were right and perfect. And I'd just turn away from anything which was wrong or needed fixing. If any monks came to tell me there's something wrong, say later on in the afternoon, not now. Any arguments, I don't want to hear that. In the afternoon I can hear that. No complaints, no looking for what was wrong. So I learned how to go to my monastery in Serpentine and look at that monastery like you look at the monastery. See, it's beautiful, wonderful, what a peaceful place. But sometimes when you're living there, sometimes you can't see the beauty which you visitors can see. What I saw was, you know, the paths which needed being swept, you know, the gutters which needed being sort of cleaned, you know, the things which were wrong and needed fixing. Because I was a manager, the fault finder. And you got into that role so much you could never enjoy the monastery in which you lived. So I trained myself to do it another way. One morning a week to go in there and be a visitor, not a manager. Appreciate it. Have gratitude for all the work which has been done. All the good things which were there. It meant that I died as a manager in the morning. I was just being a visitor. To be able to enjoy without interfering. And I could appreciate it as you see it. It's like your home sometimes. People say, oh, you've got a very beautiful home. You can't see it because all you can see is the things which need to be fixed up. Whereas sometimes someone will come and look at you and say, you're a beautiful person. And you think, ah, oh, come off it, because you can only see the things which need to be fixed up. That's why you look at the moment and you sort of see the things which are wrong with it. That's why you can never be at peace. So after a while, you look at this moment and say, what a beautiful moment it is. You're not fault-finding anymore. Then you're at peace. Sure, there's no doing possible anymore. That part of you dies. But another part of you is born. The beautiful, enlightened Noah. Okay? That's a great thing to do that. In your house, listener, every now and again, just go in there and just look at all the beauty, the wonderful things which you have. Look at your house like a visitor, not like an owner. Dear Ajahn Brahm, oh, this is very nice. You are a source of energy on the path of Dharma. May you be able to guide many on this noble path. May you be happy. May all your aspirations be filled with Metta, your mother. That's not from Mom. Very kind of you to say things like that. Ajahn, I have found that after a deep walking I have found that after a deep walking meditation, it can be difficult to settle into sitting meditation directly afterwards. Should I take a little break in between? Your thoughts very much appreciated. That's interesting. Because usually after a deep walking meditation, you can just actually glide into the sitting position and then sit down. Sure, at the very beginning, because you're changing something, you'll be letting go of a bit of stillness, a bit of discomfort, a bit of comfort. It'll be disturbing at first, but just stay there. The disturbance won't last all that long. As long as you let go, just be peaceful with the moment. And sometimes it's, you know, what happens even in sitting meditation, you change your posture to it as gently as you possibly can. It is a disturbance, but if you know how to do it properly, it's not much of a disturbance. So see if you can actually, from walking meditation, glide onto the sitting cushion. And accept it won't be as peaceful as it was a few moments ago. Just leave it alone, and you'll soon get back to the peace you were in when you were walking, and be able to take it even deeper. If that doesn't happen, I'm not quite sure why. Come and ask me in the interviews. Because usually, when you get a deep walking meditation, that's so nice. You go and sit, and there's a little bit of disturbance for the first minute or two, and then you're back there again and take it even deeper. Have a wonderful time in your sitting meditation, after a deep walking meditation. What you sometimes people can do, is having a very deep walking meditation, stop and sit down right there on your walking path. See what happens then. Because sometimes you don't need to sort of come all the way into here. Just sit down where you are and see if that peace deepens. The point is that when you're walking meditation, it's so hard to get into jhana when you're walking because there's too much going on. But if you sit and close your eyes, then you may be able to get into a deep meditation. According to my good friend Ajahn Dhammo, there is one monk in Thailand who can get into jhanas while he's doing walking meditation. It's not recommended though, because he keeps on bumping into trees. He's got all these bruises and cuts. Because if you do get into jhana, you haven't got a clue what's going on. If you start when you're walking, just carry on walking. It's like sleepwalking, only worse. Keep bumping into things. So it's not meant to be recommended. So if you do feel like you're getting into jhana when you're walking, sit down quick, please. So you don't get sued afterwards. Okay, so. That's good timing, just on 9 o'clock. Thank you for all those great questions. If I didn't answer them all, especially about the one about nuns, because we can go on for ages about that one, nuns and seniority, but it doesn't really relate to the meditation. So we can discuss that afterwards at the end. But everyone else, great questions. Thank you a lot for asking those questions. Sometimes it's not for you, but for other people. So thanks very much for your compassion. And now the questions are over. Now the nights are getting more and more peaceful. As your mind is getting brighter and brighter. And as your mind gets brighter and you get more energy, sometimes you look at those beds and think, no, not for me. No? I try the best. And you think, wow, I just heard about all these amazing things about changing perceptions. And look upon those beds as being, yeah, yucky. You know, more people die in bed than anywhere else. So you get afraid of laying down in those beds. Those death traps. But I don't know of anybody who's died on the meditation cushion. So whatever it is, just enjoy yourself. So if you feel like, okay, it's good, I've got energy. If you feel a bit tired, have a little bit of a walk for 1 or 2 minutes and see if it really is tiredness or just a bit of boredom. And if you feel good, come back and have a meditate. Doesn't matter what time it is. When you feel tired, go and take a break. Go and take a nice rest. Get up in the morning any old time. So keep the energies in the body really nice. When it's time to sleep, you sleep. When it's time to get up, you just get up. So don't worry about the clock. Don't worry about, oh, I've got to have my 6 hours beauty sleep. You're all old enough now, you don't need beauty sleep anymore. It's a complete waste of time. So, it's true, isn't it? So always just to forget about those things. And just enjoy yourself, have fun. Okay, see you tomorrow morning.